The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
We see it, I think, in the way that Dr. King intended it, that you have to look beyond the fierce urgency of now. There are many political pundits who actually don't understand the meaning, and they use it in the exact wrong opposite way. They quote it as though the moment is the fierce urgency of now, and we have to plug up all these holes, and this is what we're doing, and have no vision, no guidance, no insight into the future. And that's absurd, and it's hilarious. Stupidity to me is hilarious. It doesn't depress me anymore. It's just hilarious.
It's a wonderful chaos. Beautifully random, messy and glorious.
Solo or tandem,
we work to find rest and fight to find peace. Both head and the heart,
like a nephew and niece.
What are we doing here?
You mean listening to this show?
Where the more that you learn is the less that you know. Where the wounded are healers
and the atheists pray.
It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way.
Today.
Stefano?
Stefano De Frey.
De Frey.
So Stefano was someone who came into my Facebook feed. I saw him and I loved what I saw. And what I loved was that I just loved the authentic way that he was showing up online. What came out was I saw that in time he was also producing films. He recently produced a film called The Day I Had to Grow Up. And that film has gone to the festivals. It's won some awards. And I saw him doing some TV interviews, and the TV interviews were always 5 minutes and like didn't get into any detail, which always, you know, doesn't interest me. So we do it. So it's an hour, and we're going to do that. And we're going to talk to him about this incredible documentary on
A Wonderful
Chaos. The movie, The Day I Had to Grow Up, was just released, and it's just gone through the film festivals. And I watched it twice. And what I thought was really fantastic was that it's actually a simple movie in that he brings together six activists that are all 18, 17, right? And what he's doing is he's bringing them and letting us hear their voice in a way that it becomes, I would almost say, understandable from our generation, how these people are looking at specifically things like the climate crisis, equality, Black Lives Matter. So all the big ticket items, but he does it in a way where it's hard to diminish or make these individuals smaller because they're so eloquent in how they present themselves that you understand that they're able to see things that the older generations aren't willing to take a look at. And I found that really a fantastic a thing, because I think when we look at the voices of activists today, especially from the lens of people who've lived a lot longer, there's a lot of dismissing. There's a lot of people saying, hey, they haven't gone through what we've gone through. They don't understand. So there's a lot of people trying to make them smaller. And what this documentary does is it really gives these individuals a platform to speak. And then there's interwoven the scenes and what they're really reacting to, be it climate or be it gun violence or social issues. So, and he's just a sweet individual in general. So I thought, what a great time to spend with him for an hour. And now he doesn't have to do a five minute or 3 minute plug for the movie, but he has an hour to talk to us.
Let's bring him on.
I think we bring him on. Hello.
Hey.
How does it feel to have to speak for more than 3 minutes on a show?
Liberating. I would say liberating. I obviously overdressed. I should have brought my pajamas or my, my class.
Onesie.
My onesies.
So the one thing we have to address without without going any further is you've got Barbra Streisand on the wall behind you. So that's a big statement.
Listen, with the blonde hair and the cheekbones, it's a dangerous combination to be grouped into one category of guys.
I can tell you, my assumption of you from the beginning was that you were gay because you were too loving and effeminate. So I, as you can imagine, have the same. And I love Barbra Streisand. So I was singing Barbara on the road yesterday with my wife. And she just looks at me like I'm a freak. And I'm like, babe, this is the Barbara. She's got to come out.
So I don't know how much I should say, but
reveal everything.
Reveal everything. Let us hear from the beginning.
So I love the assessment of Barbra Streisand. That is 100% correct. But I cannot take credit for all of this. My girlfriend is on Broadway, and she's a Broadway icon who actually has had some run-ins, some positive run-ins with Barbra Streisand, because they used to share the same theater, the same dressing room at the Winter Gardens Theater in New York City. So I have letters to my girlfriend that I wake up to in the morning from Barbra Streisand, and it's actually quite necessary for the relationship to work, to be lubricated, as it were, to indulge in Barbra Streisand. As a filmmaker, I liked, Tarkovsky, Godard, Antonioni. Funny Girl, What's Up, Doc? And
Mirror Has Two Faces. Has Two Faces.
Right. Was not the top of my Criterion collection. However, we do many strange things for love. And I have become a fan now of Streisand. A genuine fan, which is frightening in and of itself when you realize, oh, I've got the capacity to really love these American standards. I do love her a lot. I do. Yeah,
that makes two of us.
But these are not. I can't take credit. Sierras. They're not.
I love it. Well, Bombos hates when I sing Jesus Christ Superstar to him. So
right.
I do my best to sing as often as possible.
He does.
You should. You know, you guys, I mean, I really love the American standards and the big bands and all the things that are playing and how that vibe is. And it, you know, singing brings out that sense of joy and community with people. And many people are afraid to sing. But I find in European cultures, people sing all the time, whether you have a good voice or a bad voice or whatever your voice is. And I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah. I bought a karaoke machine for my nieces on the weekend. And I spent the whole time singing Bruce Springsteen songs. To the nieces.
I just did Born to be Wild once on stage. It was really bad.
It was his life.
What are your go-to karaoke songs? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
It just happened for me. I did it once and it was awesome for me.
I lived in Japan for 2 years. And what happened was, I remember Let It Be was a song that they like, because in karaoke in Japan, you don't decide what you're going to sing. Someone says, hey, I want him to sing this.
Right.
So I get the microphone and I just realized that singing wasn't meant for me. And that song is the only one I've sort of, from that moment forward, everything has gone down. So,
But Andy, Let It Be is a hard song to pull off.
It is. It's really hard.
I mean, it's, you know, I try to go with I try to go with AC/DC, you know, like any AC/DC song that's going to rock, even if you're singing it bad, it really doesn't make a difference. I also like Toto's Hold the Line. People always think of them for Rains in Africa, but there's a song, Hold the Line. Love isn't always on time.
I know. Oh, I do. I like doing Elvis, because Elvis, I could disguise my voice. Oh, bless my soul. So if I can disguise my voice, then I can sing. But if I have to really sing, that can't happen.
Right. So you can joke sing. If you can joke
you don't,
sing.
You don't know what you're doing, Stefano.
Stop it.
After the show, we're having dinner together. and this means he's not going to shut up. But it does mean I'll be filming it and sending it to you.
Yes,
I want to see. I want to see the video. I want to see the videos of him singing. I got to see this.
I would like to go to the topic of this show finally.
Sure, we can do it.
I watched the documentary twice.
Yeah.
The first time just to take it in, the second time to take notes. And what I really liked in it is I have to say that there's a voice of the younger generation that's hard to listen to at times, because what it does is it's so dominating and not able to hear it screaming so loud that it doesn't actually allow a dialogue. And what I saw is that you picked six activists who are not only strong in their moral compass, but clear in how to communicate it in a way that they could not be dismissed. And that was what was so beautiful, what I found. And the character, and I say call him a character, but he is sort of a character, the Jeremy, I don't know his last name, but he, for me, was almost like a spiritual guru to the future. Like if you just listen to the statements that he makes and don't put a context of it being that he is an activist, but just think of him as somebody that has done a lot of personal work. And these are the things you become aware of when you've done, then you kind of can listen to him almost like you would. We spoke earlier about like a Ram Dass, because he's speaking insight, not really activism on one level. So I just love to feed that back to you very quickly before we start.
Well, first, Andy, I think that the insight that you brought in that question and that observation is extremely thoughtful. And I think that on a 1 to 3 level, the three, this triangle that we have right here, it's intentional. It's 100% intentional because I knew early on that there needed to be a centeredness and there needed to be space for silence and space for listeners. And I think when I was meeting, I must have started off with 35 activists meeting them all throughout, and I could see which ones were into their prepared speeches of what they wanted to say and the ones that were vulnerable enough to listen, because dialogue requires, as we know, and as we get older and in the relationships that we are in our real lives, it's vulnerable. It's vulnerable to listen. You could be wrong. You see things from a different perspective. Silence is vulnerable. And they don't have those tools. Not all, you know, I would say the majority of them don't have those tools early on. So finding that is a big part of my directing and stewardship.
Yeah.
Going back to Jeremy, I found him extremely wise when I first met him. And I was just finishing up a documentary that was on NBC. And it was the first documentary that I had ever really directed, because most of my background is in narrative filmmaking. So, of course, there was questions. People asked me, you know, when's your next doc? What are you going to do? And I had maybe 10 things on the list. But when I saw Jeremy, when I saw him protest the first time, I really believed. I was like, this, okay, I like this. I just knew I just liked this kid. I felt... And when I got to know him, all his tastes were old. He reminded me a little bit of myself. He listened to Blood on the Tracks by Bob Dylan. There are little weird things that I look for as a director that are not normal to talk about in film environments. But if I, you know, he liked Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and he read Vonnegut, and he liked he was weird. You know, he was a bit like me. Like, he liked the Beats and he liked Ginsberg. Mm. He loved Allen Ginsberg as a poet. And I become sympathetic, and I have to be careful because I can get very attached to my subjects, for better, for worse. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work, but with him it worked. And I needed to know if I could go on a journey with him. So
yeah,
yes, I found him very wise. And that's authentic, and that's true. He really is like that in real life.
Yeah, you could feel that, because in the Bombos, we talked about, you didn't get a chance to see the film. I was trying to explain a little bit to him before we got on. But the thing that what I saw was the centerpiece for all of the movie was clearly him, for those who haven't seen the movie, which many wouldn't have, is that basically he shows up at a protest where he's basically shouting into a megaphone at Pelosi's office, where he's just in front of inside the Capitol. And just in the most passionate, articulate voice, crying and screaming at what there was quotes that he wrote that were, which I just started to like, if you listen to it slow, you realize how incredibly wise he is when he says, I wrote down, we are asking you to grow up. We are asking you to, the 18-year-old speaking to we're asking you to grow up. You know, it was just the most powerful thing for an 18-year-old to be screaming at the House Speaker. And then telling all of the things that he needed to see different through the guise of obvious, through the eyes of any logical individual can understand that this is a broken system. So grow up, you know, it was intense to listen to him. Of course, that video got 1.4 million views in a very short time, of course. So
correct.
Yeah.
Correct. He worked on his personal story, Bambos and Andy. He worked on that personal story. He worked on that. This is a guy who worked on the words that he was going to say like a poet for a very, very long time. And how to, he would tell me a lot, you know, I tried to figure out how my personal story, my personal narrative would work into the greater whole, how it could transition into the idea of climate change. This is a someone who focuses on intentionality. And I hope he stays in politics. I know, you know, I think about Jeremy as a person a lot. He's so good and his heart is so open. I know that when we were editing the film, he was at Harvard, and I know he dropped out to go back after the Sunrise Movement. So he's the real deal. He doesn't care about a lot of prestige. So, yeah. You know, we keep in touch. I'm closest to him and maybe two other activists in the group.
It almost felt like he had a little bit of an autistic streak to his nature from the video, almost reminding me of Greta in a way where what I feel like in the younger generation, when somebody has an acute awareness, like because you have more of an acute awareness if you're looking at the details. So it's almost like your adults are saying, don't worry, it's okay. So you've got this kind of fringe group of people who sort of should have authority, but then you're sitting with what you know to be true. And I see him and a Greta as these people that said, this is so obvious, why do I need to explain it to you adults? And then and it's almost like the autism of knowing it's true, it almost takes over, and then they become these people that mobilize.
Yes.
And it felt very similar for him as her.
Yes, yes. I think the comparison is drawn quite often. The one thing that I would say, because I'm in the Jeremy camp, I'm in his corner.
Yeah.
In contrast to Greta, who I believe is a great advocate. You know, Greta often will say things like, you know, this is not fair. I should be in school now, and like, you know, she'll go on and on about the implications of how it's affected her upbringing and her life.
Yeah.
Listen, not my style. It doesn't appeal to me, but it certainly galvanizes an entire generation of people. Jeremy doesn't do that. What Jeremy does is completely different. He says, let's grow up together. Let's come along together. It's a very different narrative intention and a very different narrative form.
Because he is not against. That's right. What's brought up, which was, and we can talk about, because we discussed that you have your connection to Ram Dass, and I'm very sensitive to this. I talk about it a lot on the show, and is that this kid, what he did, which was so beautiful, was that he wasn't against the thing. He was inviting people to look at things in the way that seems more obvious without the, you're an idiot. It's more like, how could we get here? And I need you to look at things differently. It's an invitation.
Without alienating.
Yeah. With he's going to alienate by the mere fact that he's raising his voice, but he's not raising his voice to alienate. He's raising it to call attention to invite. That's how I would articulate it.
That's very insightful. Yeah. And I would say that's 100% the same interpretation that I have.
Yeah.
And why I was so drawn to that message, because you can find so many climate activists. You're so right, Andy, on that idea of the invitation. And he says it, you know, come with us and we'll grow up together. You know, shepherd us, mentor us, and we will grow up together. I wonder if you remember, Speaker Pelosi, when I was the chairman of the High School Democrats of America, how well-dressed we were, how attentive we were, how focused we were when we brought these propositions to you. I wonder if you remember, because we be, and he's basically saying, you know, this is an opportunity for you to use us who are now looking up to you for guidance.
Yeah. Yeah. I had some notes around that specifically. And he, what I love, one of the things he said was that young people are the best in the best position to change because they're at the intersection of criticality and hope.
It means they see the world's pain and the world's possibility at the same time.
Yeah. And what I would say is that sometimes, not always, but a lot of times the opposite true for adulthood, which would minimize and say, hey, this can happen some other point. There's nothing to do now. We don't need to do it now.
Not us on this podcast across from New York all the way to to the Netherlands, you know, not us, but some adults for sure.
Yeah. But yeah. Anything coming up for you, by the way? I've talked quite a bit.
Well, I haven't watched the documentary, so I feel I'm more witnessing and learning as we're going along. But I see that when Andy speaks, he's really touching points in you and you're lighting up.
Yeah.
And it feels like he's really listening. He really got the documentary, and that's important, I see.
Yeah. I mean, he would be the ideal audience member who comes out and, you know, just gets it. Yeah. It's, you have many people who enjoy it. They like it. It's touched them. They're moved. They cry during the Parkland section. There are many sections that they cry, but to have an audience member and a viewer who understands it emotionally and intellectually and spiritually and where it exists in its sort of time in modern times in America and in youth activism is quite rare. That's a triple. You're hitting a triple play.
But that sucks. So I want to go back to this is where. So I'm no different.
People are different, Andy. I mean,
no. But I'm going to say this is no different than Jeremy, because Jeremy, when he was working at the bookstore after he'd done this major speech, he was quite well known.
Right.
And people would come to him and then say, Jeremy, oh my God, that was incredible. That was great. That was, you know, and then Jeremy, not unlike me, is like, who cares? You do the same. Like, be an example of the thing that you want to see more of in the world. So don't look to others to be your inspiration. You be the inspiration yourselves. And that's what was kind of the beautiful. And he said in another quote that I wrote down a few is, we are not gifted with righteousness. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea of being special is part of the problem. Like, just go back to the roots of being and let people see you in the incapacity and the fact that, and that I think that's the problem, is that when we look at politics, no one can leave themselves vulnerable because everyone's trying to attack everyone else. So if everyone was honest, then what we would all say is we have no idea how to combat climate change. And then we'd say, okay, great. Now, no, we don't need to diminish anybody. What are the things we can do together to make it work? And since we never can get to that point because everyone's already going from this righteousness, you know, he's, as he said, because if he was gifted with righteousness, he would obviously be alienating people. Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, sorry to get on a high horse.
No. And also, I think what marries that to no one is gifted with righteousness, and also that what, to transcend that humanism and all your flaws is courage. Yeah. We need courage. And I was inspired by Jeremy in that moment. I remember it. And I was inspired in the editing room. I mean, I use it in a very specific way as a cut point and a, you know, as a transition into something else, into seeing him in his physical speech. courage, you know, the courage to know that as well. There's a lot of
And you would say, and I would say if Jeremy were here, he would say it's not courage. He doesn't have a choice. For everyone else, it's viewed as courage because everyone looks outside of themselves and says, what is it they're doing that I'm uncomfortable doing? But I don't believe Jeremy feels like he has a choice. He just, this is what he's been called to do.
Yes, yes. And I think the nice things about growing up and becoming an adult is that the reasons we need courage and need to be inspired to stay young is because choices cost us something. Yeah. They cost us marriages. They may cost us our kids. They will cost us our career. They will have financial dents in us. When you're younger, you can give that away quite quickly because and you can burn very fast and intensely. And that's the beauty of youth. But the real grace in our 30s and 40s, particularly in our 40s, is grace of people who are still making risky, courageous choices that have consequences. Yeah. And you know, that's another set of teachers that have to be there for each other to talk to each other as mentors in our 40s and our late 30s.
I just remembered how we met, by the way. Do you remember how we met?
Clubhouse.
Clubhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, you posted a beautiful question on Clubhouse, which I could immediately connect to. And then we interacted through Clubhouse and then I found you on Facebook. So that was basically how we found one another. Wasn't
that nice?
I
really love Clubhouse. As a form, I haven't been on as recent as I was, I would say, in the wintertime. But I really like Clubhouse because you have to show up with your voice. You have to show up as you. You can't mindlessly just write or type anything. You have to be, your presence has to be there. And that presence changes, you know, it really demands something.
And what I loved what you did, which was quite a beautifully, again, showing an example of vulnerability in a state where it might not have been great, is in a group of 30 or 40 people, of which you wouldn't have known many or most of these people, you stated openly a problem and challenge you were going to be facing the following day. Mm. And it wasn't a small challenge you were actually posing to this group. It was, I believe you said you were filming something in the I don't know if it was the World War II, the sex slaves that were there, and that you were doing filming around this subject matter, and you were having a challenge saying how to connect to your own emotions and be present. And it was like not a kind of question that it would be easy to set to an open group of people you don't really know that well. So you had a lot of admiration for me because I'd be like, God, I don't want everyone and their poor opinion to be chiming in on my life. Like, it's hard enough to get clarity in my own head. Having 80 opinionated people is not what gets me clear. That's at least for me, right?
But, you know, but Andy, you're so open and receptive that, I mean, already this friendship has blossomed from something to Clubhouse to us talking this morning when I was up around Central Park and then now in this conversation. But I know this about myself temperamentally, just like you know things about yourself temperamentally. I'm gravitated towards nuclear bomb-y type of issues. The first documentary I ever did was a documentary on a woman's shelter and the Me Too movement and sexual abuse. Yeah, was I aware that people were going to criticize me because I was a man doing this documentary? Absolutely. And you fucking take it, but you still hold on to a vision. If you know you're doing something pure and you're connecting to those people and you're doing, I think, a service, and it's in service of their lives and their courage, then you're okay. You're gonna be all right. But I've always been a bit weird. I don't mind hot topics. I've been a guest a lot on the Black News Network and the Black News Channel. On BNC, literally stands for Black News, BNC, Black News Channel Live. And yeah. I've been a recurring member, actually coming back, and I've learned a lot of things from them. And you will get questions that are sometimes, you know, you'll think they're kind of unfair. But that's okay. I don't mind.
Who are you? Who are you as a white privileged male to be answering anything on our channel?
Yeah, well, I think what starts off, like anytime any groups get together, is there's an us and there's a them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether you're black or white or Muslim or Christian. There's a tribalism that exists in us.
Yeah.
And how could it not? It's existed in us for 10,000 years. It existed in us.
Yes, it's very much when they do studies, if anyone wants to look into it, there's things that they call in-group studies,
right,
where they do tests in babies, and babies are showing biases even before they've been socialized.
Correct. These are not... Many people want to blame, in a lot of secular societies, we want to blame these are socially constructed. These biases are built in within us. And so we're working actually the opposite way. We're trying in our society to sort of, you know, get beyond those things. That's just my
opinion. You know who I've seen who I love when he answers is Denzel Washington. Mm. Like Denzel Washington, like whenever he speaks around, he like when someone said it's the black something or other, I saw a video with him. He says it's cultural. Like if he was talking about why some directors would be more adequate for some films than other directors. Mm. And his thing was like, hey, like Martin Scorsese wouldn't be doing a romantic comedy, or this person would. So it was really nice to see how he was really embracing that this is part of life and like get over it. Like, yes, really. There was something that Bambos, we've discussed a lot on the show, or sometimes at least, something else Jeremy said that I really liked. And it was in the van going to the thing. He said, the essence of someone's life cannot be separated from the people that we surround ourselves with. And that who we surround ourselves with has deep implications.
Yes.
Mm.
And when he said that, like it was a profound statement that's said in a skipping van trip. But that really, like if there's one thing often I've spoken to Bambos is that when one is going through a change in their lives and they stay in a group, which is like validating old behaviors that they don't, either drug addiction or like people that are very racist or whatever it is in their own ways. If you're in those groups, then it's very hard for you to evolve out into a whole nother paradigm of being. So or in his case, he was surrounding himself with people who were very aligned with what he was trying to achieve and therefore upped his game. So that I thought was really sweet.
A great quote to pick
intentional.
Out. And intentional.
Intentional. Classic,
intentional. Yeah. And also the fact that we're interconnected with the people that we are. We're linked to that. And I think Marcus Aurelius says something similar to it. It's talked about in Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. You know, you show me your friends and I'll show you your future. Show me, you know, these kind of mantras and these metaphors and similes and ideas really transcend time. They're eternal.
Yeah. Another one. Sorry to beat over and over again, but there's a lot of notes I made. In the
it sounds like when I read his books, I had to highlight half the book, or actually most of the book, and it feels like he's highlighted most of your film.
It's quite nice. It's quite
nice. because each element, like things came up for me, which showed, you know, I always look at content as a mirror back to myself. Mm. So who cares what you put as content? It could be the worst content imaginable, but if it brings something up in me, then it's great, because that's the journey is an internal one. It's just the stimulus is in the film. So one of the questions you said in the film was you sat everyone down with the six and said, hey, what's the single word that comes up when I tell you the next word? Mm. And then the word you gave was democracy.
Mm.
And first of all, my question is, what made that you ask that question?
I think the answer can split into a thousand different ways. And I'm always curious when I meet activists or people that are politically involved, what their idea is of a democracy. I mean, what is that idea of having a voice in a pluralistic society? And you know, I think, and the answers, I think, really describe the gamut of, I mean, they range from individual to empathy, hope, I don't know, strength.
You had every single individual on the show gave a different answer.
Correct.
So that was, and what I found fascinating, and this is why I don't have much hope for humanity.
Okay. There's still time. I may do another documentary to just call it hope for Andy?
It may be. We had a guest on about 2 weeks ago. What was her name now? I'm trying to think. I could see she has a channel, Ever Widening Circles.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And all she did is she created a network of good news, just good news. Mm. So we're on the show and I give her my doom watch feelings. And then I could see her immediately switching and giving me the compliment, which would be the positive. And I could actually feel myself feel better and feel connected to her as she did it. So I was even grateful to her. But
it worked.
Ulrich was her last name. But the thing is when you ask them, what is democracy? They said individual, unity, empathy, hope, and strength. So think about the paradox in this, which just hit me, was the paradox theory. I've got individual and unity. And then I've got empathy and strength.
Right.
So you're really pointing out like the paradox of a democracy is that we're holding these things, which we want to give everyone a voice, but everything has to be done a certain way.
Right. It requires individuals with individual thoughts and individual voices and individual needs to agree or to find a sense of unity to a vision. And to agree on that vision and to maybe compromise, I would say a lot of compromise, to picking that decision. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you see it in the parties as well. I mean, you see it. I've spent so much time, you know, on political films. I think there are four parties in America. If people ask me on a television program, I think that there are. There's the left of the Democratic Party. There's the group that I belong to, which would be the moderate centrist Democrats, who have problems often with the left cancel culture parts of the Democratic Party, but are Democrats in social issues, woman's right to choose, gay rights, and believe in the federal government's ability to have programs to take care of people. You have moderate Republicans who are not fans of Trump, but are still moderate Republicans. Often people think that they don't exist, but they do exist across America. And there's a large number of them. They're just not the loudest microphone. And then lastly, you have the Trumpsters. So to me, there are four parties in America, and it's quite a diverse group of people.
I think that's really well stated, because I, of course, feel the same in those parties, because you can't associate the far left or the far right with the centrist in either side.
Yeah.
And it's sort of sad because the loudest voice often gets the microphone.
That's exactly.
And the loudest voice on either of those sides are the ones that are getting the most exposure, which is just painful.
Right.
Because in the end, I haven't voted in an American election until the last one.
Mm.
And I haven't voted because as a kid, I felt if I vote in this system, I'm implicitly agreeing to the system.
Mm.
And I see that this system is so limited that I don't want to participate in the system that I see. I say, you can have chocolate or vanilla, and it's a democracy. You can have whatever you want, but you can have chocolate or vanilla. And I'm like, hold on. Like, I don't think that like all of chocolate is good, and I don't think that all of vanilla is good. So like now you're forcing me to like you're convincing me, which is the worst part of you're even indoctrinating me to say this is the most free society in the world, but you got two choices. And it's like, hold on, there's something doesn't feel right here. You're forcing me and telling me how free I am, and now you give me two choices. It just doesn't feel good.
But Andy, you're a perfect primary voter. You're a guy perfect for your whatever political party you want to be a part of to be in the primaries, because that's where you'll get your nutrients from, because that's to me the real vision of the party going forward. Once it makes the final race of the baton, it's 80% already set up. But when you look at the difference between voting for Joe Biden to Elizabeth Warren to Bernie Sanders, you got some big difference. You got some big difference on corporate taxes. You got big differences on how you're going to use energy. You got big difference on who's going to work with Congress. I mean, you're going to have pluses and minuses on everything. I think in some ways, following politics quite closely, I think Joe Biden feels more comfortable dealing with Mitch McConnell on infrastructure than he does with AOC. I mean, certainly knows him a lot longer. And I don't think that if you would have had a hard left Democratic president, you would have not had an infrastructure bill that would have been bipartisan.
No, obviously not. Just on principle alone.
No.
By the way, we have some things coming in, so it'd be good. But let's just see. This is interesting. Bolalong from South Africa. Is it possible to change by being mentored into a system that's rotten? This is a very good, going back to earlier on our discussion when he said, hey, I came to be mentored in a suit. And it's a really good question. And it went back against, which I didn't touch on, with democracy. If the democracy is so flawed, adapting to that system, the paradigm, which is not functioning, how really healthy is that? Is it that the system has to collapse so that it can be built in another shape and form? Right.
I think the answer has. I think there's two answers to that. The first is we look at historical governments that have turned over. So you can look at Venezuela. You can look at the collapse of the Berlin Wall. You can look at the USSR into Russia. You have to look at whatever empirical data that we have that has happened. So I'm a centrist. I believe that change happens within those political structures, and that rather than burning it down, you have to make changes within, because people change and people have to be educated, and you work with the system that you have. But I'm not against, I mean, obviously the end of, you know, when the Pope was elected and was from Poland, there is no doubt that because he was Polish, it galvanized Poland, which was a country that no one thought would be the first to leave the USSR, to start to break down that system. I'm not sure that's an answerable question. I think the real answer is it really depends on the country you're in, who controls the media, who controls the state, and if you could do it in China, good luck. Good luck. You could probably do it a lot easier in America. Yeah. You know, it's like Gandhi. You know, at the end of his life, people said, you know, oh, how do you feel about the British? He says, thank God I had the British to go against, because they had respect for their adversaries. I mean, Gandhi against Britain works. It's a triumph story. Gandhi against Hitler in Germany is a dead person.
Yeah.
So, you know, the respect your enemy has for you is the other half of that question.
I'd like to shift a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask Bambos, because I prepared a lot, and Bambos likes to go more personal.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear what Bambos is coming up in you at the moment, what questions you might be having, the things that you might be sort of sensing.
What were you sick and tired of before you made the documentary?
I really thought I wasn't going to do a political film. I mean, I'd just gotten out of doing a film for NBC, and it was about a woman's shelter, and I was like, oh fuck, I'm not gonna. I got to do an art documentary or something. I think a little bit less. Less hot topic-y and less socially involved. Mm-hmm. But then I got sucked in. I was like, oh, I got drawn to Jeremy, and I thought, oh, this feels right. But it costs me. And sometimes I'm not sure what the next documentary, if I'll ever make another political documentary, to be honest. I work on a lot of films. I mean, yes, it's true. Andy was saying, I have done a film about comfort women of Japan's occupation in South Korea. So that sounds paradoxical as a person, but I shot a narrative modern dance film that was based on, you know, Pina Bausch and Merce Cunningham, and got me to really think more about Martha Graham and in a different world, because I, as a filmmaker, I'm quite, you know, I'm a weird guy. I'm eclectic. I like to be challenged. I need to do different art forms. I'll probably return to a political documentary, but my heart has to be ready. So I was sick of that. I was sick of political documentaries, to be honest, before I started.
Mm-hmm. And I also hear that we really focused on Jeremy. So he was really the one that brought you in. And the other five individuals?
So when I met with Jeremy and got his love of Dylan, his Allen Ginsberg love, and we had to sit down, I figured, okay, could we be friends? Could we go on a trip together? Could we bunk together as roommates for camping? Because if him and I didn't get along, and Laura and I didn't get along, my co-director, we would have, I think I would have said no right away. And I often in the beginning, and this is a compliment to Laura and perhaps a detriment to me, I quite often in the beginning try to get the conflicts in right away, because I know I'd rather start having a little bit of our creative battles, because when I start shooting, then I'm pretty just so focused on work that I want you to be good, and I want you to be your best, and I want to make you look good. So how did I find those other kids? I had 35 other kids, and I talked to Jeremy, and I sourced some of them through other activists, and some of them came through me from Jeremy. Let's say 60% came from Jeremy, 40% came from looking at all sorts of youth activists group that range from people that were interested in student debt crisis. What was my next connection after Jeremy? Probably Taylor Nicole Turner, whose best friend was killed in Parkland and was someone who attended Parkland and survived it. I think that was the other leg that I think I needed emotionally for me to keep going with the documentary, because I thought Jeremy maybe could run out of gas. You know, it's hard. Yeah. You could run out of gas in a doc after just on him. And you need a cast of characters in the film.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was hard to watch, because in her case, Bambos, like the scene he mentioned, someone cried. She's on national TV on one of the biggest morning shows in the U.S. And the interviewer says, "You were shot." "Yes, I was." And then the interviewer says, "Your friend was also shot. How was she?" And then on air, she says she died. And they didn't know that ahead of time. So it was like this incredible moment where I think what happens on TV is that it gets so sterilized that we lose the humanity of what's really going on, because we make it easier to separate. And seeing her loss immediately on TV and seeing the incapacity of the interviewers, because in a weird way, they also were almost going to continue. And it's almost like, guys, do you think this is the place for her to be? You know, like the only thing you can do is hold her. So there was a beauty in that moment to show the incapacity society has at the moment to hold space for that loss.
God, you really saw this movie, Andy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly right. And that's why I kept that section longer. I could have cut it easier to make them look good, but I left it in on purpose, the end, because it's so awkward and they're treating her like just a regular story. And this girl is in shock. And
I mean, could you imagine bringing her even on?
Like, even that kid shouldn't have even been on.
She should not have been on TV. No. There's no way. No, she's way. What? She's 16 years old at that time or something, maybe younger. Her friend is just killed next to her the day before, or that day. I don't even know if it was
that day.
And now
on the same day,
an hour before, they bring her on national TV. I could cry now feeling the pain of like even imagining. It's really hard for me right now. And they're like, "Let's get her on," you know, like, you know, it's just, but that's where we are right now as a society, is the more intense, the more in it, like if it bleeds, it leads. We got to get this. So yeah, sorry. I just wanted to key in on that.
Oh,
one as well.
I'm glad you brought up. Don't apologize. Yeah. I'm happy you said it.
Another thing that came up for me. Did you have another one, by the way?
Andy, you know what? I recently saw the film. At a festival, and I cried. And it's I've seen my film many times. Rare. It happens, but rare. But I saw it, and I cried.
This documentary.
Yeah. I saw this documentary. Yeah. And I rarely cry at my films.
Wow.
But
Gambos told me that he'll cry when he reads my books. And I picked up the book a few weeks ago, and I started to cry reading the book. And I have all these people putting the book down because they say it makes me cry. I'm just like, You'd like the books, by the way. You would, just because of our contact.
I think this one should be a movie.
You'd really like the books. You'd like the books because the books, the same nuance you're putting into film as I'm writing it into. And what it is I don't need to tell you how to live your life. I'm going to use my life as an example so you can see through my vulnerability and through what insights came from it, what you can derive from your life. But don't assume that I know the answers. I just am vulnerable enough to share my journey.
Yeah.
I think also you would click with his books because some people don't always get what he's talking about. And just the way you guys are interacting, I know it's going to touch you in a way that most people don't. How did your documentary impact your life? And if you made any changes?
It made me feel younger. And I think that the cynical part of me that had already sort of passed after the age of maybe 28, 29, on a spiritual level, was looking to connect with these kids, and it made me more idealistic. It made me return back to my idealism and not have to shun it or identify it with my brain, that I could be idealistic and it could be okay to be my age to be idealistic, and that's okay, and that's a good thing to have as an adult.
That's how does it feel to look like you're 20 years old when you're actually 37?
I think that Andy, I think we should go on a date soon. You know what I mean?
I imagine when you're with your girlfriend or your wife, or I'm not exactly no, when she's girlfriend. When you're looking at your girlfriend and you're going out, they're like, "Is this your younger brother?" You know, like this baby face that you've got. It must be. Is it in all seriousness? Did you ever have trouble with people not thinking you were younger than you were, and therefore not giving you respect because of thinking that you were too young to take the responsibility they were giving you?
Investors, yeah. When I'm for a feature film, when the investment, you know, anytime the investment gets over $200,000-$300,000, sometimes, you know, they'll want to see, they'll want to ID me.
Can you buy beer?
I can buy beer. Yeah.
He's drinking beer. You also brought a point which me and Andy also live by, and that is I heard you say that you really found it important to connect with Jeremy.
Yes.
Like if there's no connection, then there's no foundation for anything.
With everything.
Yeah, our personal relationship. If this interview is going to go well, I have to understand a little bit about Andy. I have to give something up. And I have to understand something about you, Bumbo. So I have to give something up, and I have to be open to moving into anything that comes in that's awkward, and do it in a loving, vulnerable way. And in the film is the same way. I need to know, and the thing that's even harder actually is that Jeremy's smart, and so if someone is bright, it's. I don't know if I should say this, but I'm going to say it because I love this open format. No, when we're in the room and all those things that Jeremy said, I shot a long time in that room, let's say 2 hours. But after the first hour, I pulled out Jeremy and I said, God, Jeremy, please forgive me for if you see this. I said, hey, how you doing? He said, good, good. How's it going? I said, well, if you want to do your propaganda film for the Sunrise movement, climate change movement, we're done. We don't need anything. But if you want to tell me more about yourself and your life, we've got zero. So get yourself together, okay? And let's figure. I mean, do you want to? It's really up to you. I mean, we have a Sunrise film documentary, propaganda film. If you'd like to do it about that, I've got all the footage I need. But I've got nothing yet really about you and how you feel and how uncomfortable you feel and your perspective on some of the insecurities that you have. I want the personal life. I already have your persona, but I'm looking for the personal life that is inside the persona. So let's start again, you know? And got it. He got it. But he needed, I think, and we needed, it's like, hey, I caught you. You caught me? Oh, Yeah, you're right. Okay, fuck. Okay, fine. Fine.
Yeah,
right.
This is what my life is. I have a lot of people that I coach and mentor that went to MIT, and they're even professors at MIT. And when I'm working with these people, they're so damn smart that they actually outsmart themselves. So right. Even when you're working with them, if you say, okay, let me try to help you here, like they'll already know it, but the knowing is not helping them connect back to the center and the emotional. It's right. Like you can't understand emotion, you are emotion, so be yeah. The thing, don't talk about the thing. It's wonderful to hear how you navigate it.
Go to the cry space.
Yeah, exactly. We did that on a show once, and the man started to cry. It was so. I love him. We're friends.
That's good,
and
though.
And we've had enough years together. And I said to him, and he was, it was one of the shows I really loved. I mean, he was like, so, and he made what was the movie he made? He made an animated film, and he started to answer Kirk Scott, the wonderful, yeah. Loving individual, The Nightmare Before Christmas. He did the show. Yeah. So I said, so tell us about the movie. And then he started answering, but you could hear it was coming from a memory of the past. And then I said, stop. Don't answer that question. Answer the same question from the crisis. And then he shared that was the last movie he made with a dear friend who died. Oh. So every time, and now I could cry feeling into it. He said, every time I talk about the movie, I can't separate from the loss of my friend. And even now I could feel the pain come up in myself, but it felt in a way intense for me because I was inviting him to be more emotional, but I didn't know he was going to go to the, you know, to the full Monty on it. Right.
Yeah. Well, kudos to you, but also kudos for him and the two of you to meet in the middle to want to go on that journey. It's therapeutic to cry. And if you feel safe in that environment, it's quite nice.
Yeah. You
know? It's quite nice.
Yeah, and it felt nice. There was no one felt uncomfortable. And even I reviewed all the 100 shows that were the most meaningful to me at the end of the segment. And that show I brought on because it was so powerful. And he was there watching it as well. So that we all shared in a moment that was really, really beautiful. Mm. Yeah.
We get each other to cry, Andy, next time or even in this time, you know. But I've come close. Talking about Helena Ramsey, just to give your viewers some perspective, was the girl who the film was dedicated to, and was the girl who got killed. Mm. And the story was that she used her school books to shield and to protect her friend that was being interviewed and other girls. That always gets me. I think because the idea of being so young and learning, and you know, being in. No, you should never have to worry. I mean, you should never have to be worried about being shot at school.
Yeah.
Just a kid, you know, it's you're so vulnerable and it's a mess.
Yeah. It's freaky for us in Europe to see this happening over and over again and see that the discord between what seems like such an obvious thing, like why do you need an assault rifle? Like what does an assault rifle help you do when it comes to hunting?
Nothing.
One of the things that I really liked in the film, getting back to some points, is that when Jeremy spoke, he also said, which I thought was really sweet, was when he was talking about politics going forward. Mm. He said, the new era of politics is about moral priorities, speaking clearly about moral priorities in a context of real experiences that are translated into policy. So basically what he did was he did systems thinking. He showed that he wasn't one-sidedly looking at it. He was showing I'm looking at it from the problem itself and then from the system in which it exists, which I need to solve it within, and then policies which would allow it then to exist within that system. And in that way, it was, again, one of those simple statements that if you didn't realize the insight that it takes to understand the complexity, then you could discount his way of looking at it. So that was another thing that was really quite wonderful in seeing how he addressed the issues. Yeah,
it's and from a very personal perspective of public policy, I have a harder time articulating this in politics, but I have a much easier time articulating this in business, and seeing brands that have a now vision, right? You're not just buying wheat thins. You're buying wheat thins that save the whales.
Yeah.
You're not just buying Cheerios. You're buying Cheerios that stand up against Asian hate. Yeah.
You're not just buying Nike. You're buying right. Black Lives Matter and support of Colin Kaepernick.
Correct. Yeah. Colin Kaepernick and Nike is a perfect example. Perfect example that started two, three years ago. So the social branding corporations have done this quickly, and I think quite cleverly. I think what the challenge for policy is that it's going to have to happen in a less clever, more authentic way. And that's what Jeremy's asking for.
Yeah. And asking for things to be translated into real things and not just talk, which is obviously what we see in life is that it's easy to promise something. It's much harder to deliver it.
Right.
Yeah. We've gone over our hour, but I have a question for you. Given that you're always given 5-minute segments on shows, are there any things we have not discussed that you would have liked to have had brought in? Because we can always extend and have a little bit more playtime together.
I think what I want to say the most is actually from this whole hour, I'm the most touched by the insight, the consciousness, Andy, that you have. I don't think I've ever met anybody who saw the film in the way that I intended it to be seen. And that feels quite personal to me.
Thank you. Well, I Bambos knows that when I look, I don't really feel as though I'm looking at a thing. I experience myself looking at a thing. So when I'm looking, I'm saying, what is it doing to me? What does it make clear? What does it affirm? Where does it go against something I might have thought? And then it's a journey that I get to take. So thank you for taking me on that journey. It was really, really beautiful. Another quote, which I thought was great, which would be nice to end on, is that when he mentions, I say, Jeremy, is that the fierce urgency of now, referring to Martin Luther King, and how it's easy to get caught up in it. And I think what we as society is, where we get dangled a carrot in front of our nose, and that's the fires that are existing, the floods that are existing, and then we have to solve these little things, not realizing that there's so many bigger things that are going on around us that we're not even allowing ourselves to see, because the first urgency of now is always in front of us.
Right.
And it's hard to change anything when you're always living in that fierce urgency. Because it's just scary, it's reactive, it's basically what you talked about. It's the extremes of the polarity. Deep, deep fear or deep, deep hedonism. Like, but there's some space in the middle where there's balance.
And the way you see it, and the way Jeremy sees it, and the way I see it, we see it, I think, in the way that Dr. King intended it. That you have to look beyond the fierce urgency of now. There are many political pundits and many politicians who actually don't understand the meaning, and they use it in the exact wrong opposite way. They quote it as though the moment is the fierce urgency of now, and we have to get all the stove off the things off the stove, and we have to plug up all these holes, and this is what we're doing, and have no vision, no guidance, no insight into the future. And that's absurd, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Stupidity to me is hilarious. It doesn't depress me anymore. It's just hilarious.
I have to say, I always say when I'm in really difficult situations, sometimes I feel like I'm playing chess with people that are playing checkers. Yeah. They think each move is the next move. No, we're playing for 4 moves out. The first move is not important. You show yourself in the first move.
Right.
But actually what we're really trying to do is your 4th move, where you really expose yourself. Thank you, Stefano.
Thank you, Stefano. Thank you.
Guys, great. Thank you so much for having me and for this conversation.
It's a wonderful chaos.
We like it that way.